It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Deprive a newborn baby of loving touch, and the consequences are dramatic. In fact, touch deprivation can lead to a broad range of developmental problems that, if left uncorrected, will most likely carry over into adulthood. My guest, neuroscientist David Linden, says touch is not optional for human development. In his new book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind, Linden explains how this sense enables us to feel both pleasure and pain in what he says is a weird, complex, and often counterintuitive system of touch circuits. Linden is a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University. He's the former chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. This is his third book. David Linden, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
As you point out in the book, and as I just stated in the introduction, touch deprivation has serious consequences. Can you talk about what some of those consequences are, and why do you think touch is so important?
Well, touch is important because it is the way that we convey in an interpersonal sense that I'm not a threat to you. I'm an ally. You can trust me. This is what interpersonal touch conveys. And the particular touch that is so important is not just like the touch of picking up an object. It is the touch between people. And we really know this mostly from the terrible case of Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s that were grossly overcrowded. And the newborns and toddlers there basically almost never got touched by their caregivers because the caregivers were so overburdened, and they developed compulsive, self-soothing, rocking motions and attachment disorders and cognitive disorders. And the bad news is if loving touch isn't received within the first 2 years of life, then there will be not only those problems, but problems with the immune system and the digestive system that will persist throughout life. The good news is that if intervention comes early, it only takes about a half an hour a day of loving touch to reverse the deleterious effects of touch deprivation.
What's the significance of loving touch and the development of these issues?
The amazing answer is we don't know.
So touch involves skin, nerves, and the brain, as you point out, to create pain and pleasure. And because of this, you say there's no pure touch sensation. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, sure. Maybe it would be good to back up and just sort of talk about just a smidgen of anatomy. So touch sensation is conveyed by nerve endings that are in the skin. And there are different nerve endings that are specialized for different types of touch. There are special ones for heat and for cold and for pain and for caress and for pressure and vibration and for fine spatial detail. And all these different signals from these different nerve endings in the skin run in parallel, and they come to the spinal cord, and they eventually come to the brain where these senses are felt. Now, what I mean by there is no pure touch sensation is that we like to think that we're completely rational beings and that we get an accurate representation of the external world from our senses, and that if necessary, we can make completely logical, rational decisions based upon that correct information. And that just turns out to be utterly and completely wrong. We're getting very massaged data. By the time we are aware of any sensation, whether it's touch, vision, hearing, or anything else, it has already been blended with emotion and expectation and our own personal history and other senses to give a very complex sensory stew. There is no pure perception. An example that I like to give from this is from one of my favorite cartoons. There's a man and a woman. They're driving in a car. The man is behind the wheel. The woman has a bag of groceries on her lap. And the man says, "Oh, P.U., what smells like farts in here?" And the woman says, oh, well, that is the expensive French cheese we just bought. And the man replies, oh, well, in that case, what smells so delicious in here? And, you know, we all know that sensation is dependent on context. The same smell that's repulsive lingering in a public toilet is delightful in a cheese shop.
So you mentioned our personal history combined with other things like expectations. If I get hit by a baseball in the arm and you get hit by a baseball exactly the same place, under the same circumstances, we feel that differently?
Well, we can feel it in exactly the same circumstances is key, but there is individual variation in how people perceive things. And some of that individual variation comes with variation in the genes that control the process of sensation in the nerve endings, and other ones have to do with the way sensations are processed in the brain. So, for example, you may hear people say, well, you know, so-and-so has a high pain tolerance or a low pain tolerance. And sure enough, if you get people in the lab and you do an experiment where you say, well, how long can you stand to submerge your arm in an ice-cold bath of water, which is a standard pain test in a laboratory, well, people will vary to quite a different degree on that, and they'll vary in the kind of pain they report. So there is, not everyone is going to experience those sensations the same way, and it's not just for pain, it's for all sensations as well. There are also differences depending on how old you are.
How does age affect touch?
Well, the bad news here, unfortunately, is that we lose, you sort of have peak touch sensation at about age 20. And after age 20, you lose about 1% of your touch-sensing nerve endings in your skin every year of your life thereafter. And so you don't notice it when you're young. You really don't notice it when you're middle-aged. But by the time you're elderly, you've lost a lot of touch sensation. And when I say touch sensation, I mean every kind of touch sensation. Heat, cold, pain, sexual sensation, light, pleasant touch, caress, all of these are decreased, and this can create problems. So, for example, this is one of the reasons why it is harder for people to achieve orgasm during sexual behavior. It's because there are fewer nerve endings conveying sexual sensation in the genitals. Another more serious problem is that elderly people are often prone to disastrous falls, and there are a number of reasons for this. One has to do with problems of balance, another has to do with muscle strength, but one of the reasons is that they can't feel the ground under their feet as well because the nerve endings in the soles of the feet have been slowly reduced by age, and that's where we get some of the cues to know how to distribute our weight and move our muscles in order to balance and walk with an even gait. Another problem happens in convalescent situations with bed sores. So, you know, people, when they're in bed for a long time, can develop these horrible bed sores, and you would think, oh my God, they go all the way through the skin. They must be incredibly painful. Why is it that these are often only discovered by caregivers and not alerted to by the person who has the sore? And the reason is because a lot of those pain sensors in the skin have gone away with age.
This is David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and former chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. He's the author of this book we're talking about today, Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. So is it the nerve sensors themselves that are breaking down, or is it in the brain?
So these, what I'm talking about here, are the nerve endings that are actually in the outer layers of the skin. So if we were to take a skin biopsy from a 20-year-old and an 80-year-old and then put a stain on so that we could reveal the nerve endings, we would see many fewer sensory nerve endings in the 80-year-old than in the 20-year-old.
Why do we get pleasure from being touched?
Well, that's a great question. It turns out that we actually have a dedicated system for detecting caress. And so this particular nerve ending is one that if you look at it in the skin under the microscope, the nerve ending would wrap around the base of hair follicles and detect hair deflection. And so these caress sensors are present in your hairy skin, but not in your hairless skin. There are two kinds of skin on your body. Most of the body is covered with hairy skin, even places that we don't think of as being particularly hairy, like a woman's cheek or the inner arm. If you look carefully, they're very tiny little, what are called vellus hairs in those places. The only hairless places are really the, you know, the palms of the hands, the soles of the feet, the lips, the parts of the genitals, but not other parts, the nipples, a few other little spots. But in places with hairs, they've got these what are called C-tactile fibers. And these fibers detect caresses, and they send them to a part of the brain called the posterior insula that is involved specifically in processing pleasant pro-social touch, or caress, if you will. And the amazing thing is that these nerve endings are tuned for a particular type of caress. And when you think about this, imagine someone caressing your arm, right? And imagine if they press their hand down very, very lightly, it wouldn't feel loving. It would feel like a tickle. Mm-hmm. And imagine if they really crushed it with a ton of pressure, it wouldn't feel loving either. And then imagine if they use intermediate pressure, which feels good, but they skim it across your arm really fast. Well, that wouldn't feel good either. Or if they crawl really slow, like at the speed of an ant walking, that's not going to feel good either. So it turns out that we are hardwired to find pleasurable caresses of intermediate speed and intermediate pressure. And you might think, oh, well, okay, so I know how that would work. All these different caress signals would get conveyed to the brain, and the brain is where it would be tuned for these intermediate speeds and intermediate pressures. But it turns out that it's actually in the nerve endings. If you record electrical signals from these caress-sensing nerve endings, they are most electrically excited by intermediate speed caresses. And so this tuning that we have for the ideal caress happens before these signals even get to our brain.
So hair plays a significant role in translating or communicating touch.
Oh, it absolutely does for a subset of touch. So there are several different kinds of nerve endings that wrap around the base of hair follicles and detect hair deflection. And so you know that if someone caresses you on the back of your arm with the grain of your hairs, that feels a lot better than if they caress against the grain of the hairs. And it turns out that those nerve endings can detect hair bending either with or against the grain of the hair and convey different messages to the brain based on that sensation. Now, I think one of the most important things to understand about touch is that when these signals flow to the brain, they activate two different systems in the brain. One of them, in a region called the somatosensory cortex, is all about the facts of touch. Where am I being touched on my body? How intensely? In what fashion? With what speed? And by what kind of object? And it's all about the facts. And then there's the separate place that I mentioned earlier, the posterior insula, which is all about the emotional tone of touch, either positive for things like caresses and sexual sensation, or negative for pain, for example. And we think of, say, an orgasm as being sort of intrinsically pleasurable, and pain as being intrinsically negatively emotional. But this is just a trick our brain plays on us from simultaneous activation. So of these two different pain systems, the emotional one and the factual one. So there are people who have damage to the emotional touch centers of their brain. And if I were to go up to someone like that and whack them on the thumb with a hammer, instead of having the normal reaction, which would be, ow, oh, that's terrible, I've been hit on the thumb, it really hurts, it's awful, that person would respond, yes, my thumb hurts, it's throbbing now, yes, it's a very intense pain. But they would have a very flat tone to their voice because it would have no emotional resonance, because the emotional aspect of that pain only comes from activation of the posterior insula, the brain's emotional touch center. And if that area is damaged, then they have a condition called pain asymbolia, where the pain is there, but it has no emotional resonance. Now, importantly, these people aren't masochists. They don't like the pain. Masochists have a very strong emotional reaction to pain. It's just a positive emotional reaction. These people have no emotional reaction to pain whatsoever. And then you can imagine that if the opposite brain damage occurs, if you have brain damage to the somatosensory cortex, you lose the facts of pain. So then I hit you on the thumb with a hammer, and you would say, oh, it's terrible, it hurts, it's awful. And you'd say, oh, I'm so sorry, where on your body does it hurt? And you'd say, oh, I've got no idea, it's just bad.
Are there people who don't have either one of those systems?
There are people who don't have either one of those systems because they have damage to the sensory nerves themselves. It's usually not because there's damage in the brain in both places, although there can be very rarely. It doesn't occur that often. But there are people who lack certain touch sensations, certain aspects of touch sensation, often because of a rare genetic disease that results in the failure of development of one kind of touch sensation. So, for example, there are a few people who have what's called congenital total insensitivity to pain. And this is, their brains are normal. It's just that the nerve endings, both in the skin and in the muscles and in the viscera that convey pain sensation, are electrically silent. And so, as a result, pain signals don't get to the brain. You might think, oh, this is great. I want that. I want to have no pain sensation. What a delightful way to live. But the problem is that, you know, we need pain to live our lives properly. And people who have congenital total insensitivity to pain usually die, you know, by their 20s. And it's usually for some very mundane reason. They rub grit into their eyes unknowingly. They swallow food and drinks that scald the esophagus. They wear their clothes too tight, and the clothes dig into, and their shoes dig into their flesh, and they get bacterial infections. So without those protective reflexes that pain triggers, it's very hard to keep yourself alive in the world.
And I want to ask you a little more about that on the other side of this break. This is David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. And we've been focusing on the biology of pain and pleasure in the context of neuroscience. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a quick break. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack in for Faith. We've been talking with David Linden. He's a neuroscientist and the author of Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Before the break, we were talking about the two systems in the brain that deal with touch, one of them responsible for the facts, such as where am I being touched, in what fashion, how intensely. The other system deals with the emotional tone of touch. Is it positive, such as loving caress, or is it negative, which we would associate with pain? And we were focused on what happens when one or both of those systems are damaged. You illustrate how truly terrible this can be. You tell a story in the book about a boy from Pakistan who had no pain sensation.
That's right. So this boy was known to people in his community for his bravery. People said he could feel no pain. He was a street performer, and he would, like, insert knives through his muscles. And one day, to show off to his friends, he decided he was going to jump off the roof of a three-story building. And he did, and he landed, and he got up, and he said, I'm fine. And he walked away, and that night he dropped dead because he had had massive internal injuries. But because he had no pain sensation, he never complained to his parents. They never knew. His case was studied by a geneticist in England who subsequently used it to find other people with the same syndrome. And what they found is that there's a particular gene that's only in pain-sensing neurons that is necessary for conveying the electrical spark that moves from the nerve endings that sense pain into the spinal cord and up into the brain. And these people have a mutation such that this critical ion channel called the voltage-gated sodium channel, which is necessary for this electrical spark, doesn't work. It's just a flat line of electrical current. The exciting thing about this is that there's a magic bullet for pain. In other words, if we can develop drugs that target this particular voltage-gated sodium channel that's only in pain neurons, then we have the opportunity to create analgesic drugs that are far superior to the compounds that we have right now. For example, right now you go to the dentist and you get an injection of xylocaine to numb your jaw for dental work. Well, it doesn't just take out the pain sensations, right? It takes out all the sensations, which is why you feel so puffy and weird. And it not only blocks the nerves that send sensory signals to the brain, it also blocks the nerves that send motor signals from the brain out to the muscles, which is why, you know, the muscles around that part where they got the injection are so slack. And so if you had a compound that instead of blocking all the electrical signals in those nerves, only blocked the electrical signals in the pain-conveying nerves, well, that would be an extraordinary achievement. And people are working on this right now.
And since they've isolated these channels, does that affect chronic pain?
Well, it is relevant for one very rare form of chronic pain. So recall I said the people who can't sense pain, they have a sodium channel that doesn't work at all. Now imagine instead if you had a sodium channel and it had a mutation in it that made it work even when it shouldn't. In other words, it was spontaneously active and sent signals even when there was no pain sensation to report. And unfortunately, that is a phenomenon called chronic paroxysmal pain disorder, and you're born with it. And so what happens is, like, there's a baby in the hospital there, and even very standard touching, like changing the diaper, will cause the baby to scream in pain. And this is because they've been unlucky enough to inherit this sodium channel that is super active. And so that is a form of chronic pain, but that's a very, very rare form. It only is one tiny fraction of 1% of the total chronic pain that occurs in the world. Chronic pain, you know, is a very prevalent phenomenon, and it occurs for a lot of different reasons biologically.
Pain and pleasure, you've said, are not predetermined, and you mentioned our life history and culture play a large role in our perception of pain. How does that work when we're thinking about pain and pleasure?
Well, you know, when I say history, I'm not really referring to, like, the history of civilization. I'm referring to one's individual life history.
Right.
But let me give some examples. It's well known that soldiers in combat often receive injuries and don't even realize they're injured in the heat of combat, and it's only later that they learn that they've been hit by a bullet or shrapnel. This is the sort of thing that normally, you know, would be instantly very, very painful, but in the heat of combat, it's ignored. There's a case that I recount in the book of an Army medic who served in Iraq named Dwayne Turner, and his unit came under attack, and a grenade came over the wall, and he took shrapnel. He didn't even realize it, and he ran out and pulled 12 of his comrades to safety. And he was awarded the Silver Star for Valor by the Army. He was shot twice in the process of doing this. He didn't even realize it. And he's coming back, and his buddy says, "Hey, Doc, you've been shot." And he says, "No, I haven't been shot. That's just somebody else's blood that got on me." And they said, "No, you've been shot." He didn't even know. And it doesn't diminish his heroism at all to note that actually this is a very common occurrence in the heat of combat. And the very same soldier who in the heat of combat might be able to ignore their pain entirely, say 2 days later, they're in the field hospital and someone does a bad job doing a blood draw, you know, the kind of thing that is a little bit of pain but not terrible pain, well, they'll complain about it just like anyone else would.
But so how
it's not that they're superhuman, it's that the circumstance determines the pain perception.
How does that work biologically? How is he able to ignore his pain?
It is a subconscious process, and we don't entirely understand it, but it seems to involve the production in the brain of the brain's natural morphine-like compounds, which are called endorphins and enkephalins, and their action within the pain perception circuitry to damp down the pain signals. Now, of course, it can work the other way around, and the example I give in the book is of myself as a child dreading routine immunizations. I would be walking down the hall with my mother, you know, dreading going to the doctor because I knew what was going to happen. I would smell the alcohol pad, and I would hear the click of her high heels on the tile, and I would remember I have all the cues of the last time. And when the needle went into my arm, it would feel like somebody was putting a steak knife in and twisting it, even though, you know, really, the pain of an immunization is, like, pretty tiny. It's just that when you get so tense and you're so anxious and you're so keyed up and you're so focused on that one patch of skin, then the perception of that pain is increased dramatically. And the reason this happens neuroanatomically is because the higher parts of our brain that are involved in context and expectation and personal history and anxiety are sending signals to the emotional touch perception regions of our brain, to the insula. And those signals can either turn that pain perception up, as in the case of myself as a child in the doctor's office, or they can turn it down, as in the case of soldiers in combat.
This is David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We talked in the first part of the show about the hairless parts of our bodies, like the palms, lips, fingers, and the difference in touch perception in those areas. And so I wanted to talk for a second about the sensors in our fingertips. They're really pretty amazing.
Well, it's not that they have unique sensors. It's just that they have a lot of them packed very close together. So, for example, if you were to take two pencil tips and put the tips of the pencil, say, 3 millimeters apart and pressed them to your fingertip and you had your eyes closed and someone did this to you, you would clearly be able to tell that these are two different indentations of your fingertip rather than one. Whereas if they did that on the small of your back, where you have a very low density of fine touch nerve endings, then you would probably perceive it as a single indentation rather than two separate ones. So in the fingertips, we have a very, very high density of nerve endings, and in particular, we have a high density of what are called Merkel endings. And Merkel endings are the ones there that allow you to detect the finest spatial form. So for example, if you are reaching into your pocket for a coin and you don't pull the coin out, but you're just feeling what kind of coin it is with your fingertips and trying to determine a dime from a quarter, for example, it's your Merkel endings that are allowing you to do that. They're what allow people to read the dots that constitute Braille writing, for example. And certain areas of your body, like your fingertips and your lips, have a very high density of Merkel endings, and other areas like the small of your back have a very low density of them.
So the lack of those Merkel endings that you were just talking about will apply to this next question, and I'm sure you know where this is going. You mentioned Braille reading, and you talk in the book about a friend of yours who questioned the ability to read Braille with our genitals and decided to try it. Turns out we cannot. Can you say more about that?
Well, right. So we think of certain places in our body as being very sensitive. So, for example, the cornea of the eye is very sensitive. The genitals are very sensitive. And they're sensitive in the sense that you can detect a very tiny indentation of the skin in those places. Like a little grain of sand in your eye hurts like crazy. And a little grain of sand pressed against the skin of the genitals, either the male or the female genitals, produces a very strong sensation. And so you might think, oh, well, if those areas are so sensitive, then maybe I could do fine tactile discrimination with those areas, like read Braille. But the problem is that these areas are sensitive, but they're not discriminative. They don't have the Merkle-type nerve endings that allow you to detect fine spatial forms. And as a result, they have what doctors call protopathic sensation. In other words, they're very sensitive to tiny little indentations, but they're very, very poor at localizing. So you get a little bit of grit in your eye, it might hurt like crazy, but you have a hard time pointing to exactly the place in your eye where it's located. And the same is true with the genitals. And so if you try to read Braille with your genitals, it won't work. And if your listeners don't believe this, they can wait till nobody's around, like in the middle of the night, and go down to the ATM and give it a try themselves.
Although I'm sure you wouldn't recommend that.
Citizen science.
We use touch references in our everyday expressions, and you talk about this also in the book when we say things like, he rubs me the wrong way. Why do we do that?
Well, we are so used to using tactile expressions to refer to social interactions. I had a rough day. That politician is so slippery. All of these things have very defined social meanings. And the reason for this is that touch sense is deeply and intrinsically emotional and interpersonal. And remarkably, even our incidental touch sensation can alter our perceptions of someone's personality. And so, for example, there's some wonderful experiments that were done at Yale by John Bark and his co-workers. In one of them, people were given a job resume for a candidate and asked to evaluate it. And before they were done that, they were either holding a cup with hot liquid in it or a cup with cool liquid in it. And when they had many people do this, they found that the people who held the hot liquid were much more likely to rate the person, the resume, and it was the very same resume, as being warmer. That is to say, being friendlier, more personable, working better as a group. Now, it's not as if holding the hot liquid made you think better of that person in a general sense. They weren't rated as smarter or more competent or more serious about the job. Similarly, people were asked to rate a resume, and one of them was on a very light clipboard, and the other was a very heavy one, like a couple of pounds. And the people who read the resume that was, they were asked to hold in their hands, on the heavy clipboard rated that person as having more gravitas, that is to say, as having more serious intent about the job. But similarly, they were not rated as more friendly or better in a team or smarter or more competent. So our formation of ideas about people is heavily dependent upon touch sensations, even when those touch sensations have nothing to do with the person we're evaluating at all.
Is touch more important than our other senses, do you think?
Well, I don't think that it is more important, but I think it is more important than people realize. We tend to take touch for granted because it's always on. If you're a sighted person, you can close your eyes and you can imagine being blind, kind of. Mm-hmm. Or if you're someone who is normal functioning hearing, you can plug your ears and kind of imagine being deaf. But there's no way to imagine the loss of touch sensation. And so I think as a consequence, it fades into the background of our consciousness. But clearly, touch is central to our human experience. It is important in our pair bonding and in our social interactions, even casual touch. For example, doctors who touch their patients in a pro-social way, not just, in the course of a physical examination, but in a friendly way, their patients have better medical outcomes and they're rated as more caring. We take a lot of our social cues from touch. When people are touch deprived, as often happens, when elderly people may have lost a partner or live far from their families and get very little touch in these situations, then they're more likely to experience depression and faster rundown of cognitive ability. So touch is crucial to our human experience. I don't want to say better or worse than other senses, but it's certainly a sense that's under researched. If you do a search of the scientific literature, you'd probably find that there are 100 papers on vision for every one about touch.
So you've said that there's still a lot we don't know about the sense of touch. Is it just more complicated than the other senses?
Well, you know, they're all complicated, but I would say right now we understand less about touch than we do about, say, for example, vision or hearing that have received a lot more attention from scientists. I mean, to give one example, sexual sensation is one of the key motivators of human life, right? It guides so much of our human behavior. So many of our laws and our religious ideas have to do with controlling how sexual sensation is experienced. And you would think that we knew how it happened. Like, you'd think that if you looked in the skin of the genitals, you would find something, and that something would be the thing that made touching the genitals feel different than, say, touching the arm. Mm-hmm. But remarkably, we don't know that. If you look at the skin of the genitals, there is a kind of nerve ending there that's higher, at a higher density than it is in other places, like, say, the lips. But we still don't even know if that nerve ending conveys sexual sensation or not. And, you know, this is kind of a basic fact about touch. It's like if someone said, well, how do you see color? And we had no answer for them at all. This is kind of the equivalent for touch. And as a biologist, it's incredibly embarrassing that even now, this very fundamental fact about a central aspect of our human experience, we cannot explain at all on the level of molecules themselves.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University and the author of Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. I'm Laurie Mack in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a break and then continue our conversation with David Linden when we come back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack in for Faith. We're talking today with David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and former chief editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. He's also the author of this book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You talked before the break about some of the effects of being touch deprived, like, say, when someone loses a spouse or lives far from family. I'm wondering now about kids and parents, too, teenagers in particular. We seem to touch teens less than we did when they were younger.
You know, the thing to realize is that when we say we're not talking universally about all humanity. So there are very different cultural ideas about touching. Pretty much every culture has an idea that you should touch your children a lot, you know, your young children a lot. But, you know, for example, in the 1960s, there was an anthropologist named Sidney Gerard, and he liked to spy on people in coffee shops, and he would spy on people in different places around the world, and he found that, you know, in San Juan, Puerto Rico, people were touching each other about 200 times an hour, and in Paris, they were touching each other about 40 times an hour, and in New York City, about 5 times an hour, and in London, about 0 times an hour. And so, you know, clearly there are very different social ideas about touching in different cultures. And if you turn to teenagers, there are very different ideas. So yes, there are. In the United States, we have an idea that when our children become pubescent, we should perhaps touch them less because we don't want to have anything that would be, you know, mistaken as sexual interest in kids. But I think non-sexual touching is crucial, and there are a number of studies that have shown that kids that continue to be touched appropriately as they're growing up have better development. They have fewer behavioral problems, in large part because that touch conveys a sense of safety and acceptance and inclusion. This really plays out a lot with teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of teachers, particularly in public schools, are told never touch the kids at all. Just don't do it. And, you know, it's a problem. So I talk to teachers, and they say, well, look, you know, I teach second grade, and some little kid runs up and wants to hug me on the playground, and I have to just stand there like a telephone pole, and the kid's feelings are hurt, and I feel terrible, and I don't think this kid is being well served by this policy. I mean, the policy is triggered by a good instinct, which is, you know, you don't want to give sexual predators the opportunity to touch kids. But the problem is sexual predators are going to do what they want anyway. They're going to ignore the regulations. And what you do with these policies, the effect of it winds up being that the kind of appropriate social touching that enriches child development then becomes banned.
So what does that look like? Does that mean just an arm around the shoulder? Is it giving them a hug once in a while? Is it
Well, you know, everything is context.
Right.
Right? You know, there are situations where a hug would be appropriate and situations where a hug wouldn't be appropriate, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like you can just come up with a set of rules that says this touch is okay, that touch isn't okay, you know. I mean, there are certain things that probably nobody's going to complain about, a fist bump.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a hug, sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, one of the things that I realize, so I have two teenagers who are going off to college, and they've spent a lot of time in the last few years going to Quaker youth groups. And in Quaker youth groups, at least the ones that they go to, they really promote a lot of non-sexual touching between the kids. And, you know, the kids are always in these puppy piles, they're always giving each other hugs, they're always just kind of having this very good kind of pro-social touching. And I think it's extremely valuable for a kid to learn that, you know, you grow up and not all touching has to be in the context of sexual behavior. I feel very grateful that my kids were able to have that experience.
I don't want to end this conversation without asking about the power of meditation. And so I want to go back for a second to pain. Does meditation work?
In the same way that our pain perception can be either amplified or damped down by situations, by context and personal history, meditative practice can be used, particularly in chronic pain. It can be very effective in attenuating that pain. And there are now quite a number of studies that are showing that it can. And again, it seems to depend upon signals coming from the frontal cortex of the brain impinging upon the brain's emotional pain circuit. So, you know, from our earlier discussion, we explored how pain, for example, has both a sort of factual portion. You know, where on my body is the pain? What is its property, searing, burning, etc., and how intense is it? And then there's this separate emotional pain layer, what people call pain unpleasantness. And pain unpleasantness can be modified, it can be reduced by mindfulness practice.
We talked a little bit about things like pain medication. How do pain medications designed to relieve pain work, things like morphine?
Well, so there's a couple of different kinds of pain medication. So things like morphine. Morphine is a drug that mimics our brain's natural endorphins and enkephalins, and it binds receptors in the brain that are in pain circuitry, both in the spinal cord and at several different locations in the brain, to dull pain sensation. And morphine is a fantastic drug. I mean, it is really, really, really effective at reducing pain. The problem is it's also euphoric and it's also massively addictive, as we all know. So the thing about morphine is not that morphine is ineffective, it's that it has these side effects that really limit its utility and really make it inappropriate for chronic pain treatment. Now, there are other kinds of drugs that work in a different way. These are anti-inflammatory drugs. So drugs like aspirin and ibuprofen, they work by interfering with biochemical processes of of inflammation. So usually when you receive an injury, let's say you bruise your forearm, for example, and it's starting to swell up, that swelling is indication of a inflammatory biochemical cascade, and that inflammatory cascade keeps the pain lingering long after the time of initial injury. Now, that has a biological function. You know, for example, if you injure a limb, you want to favor that limb. You don't want to use it normally. But a lot of times that pain lingers much longer than it's useful, and so that class of analgesic drug acts against that inflammatory cascade.
You study the brain, and we've talked about just some of your research. You also look at other functions of the brain, like memory, injury, and healing. And this is a personal question, so if you're not comfortable with it, just say so. There's, as you've said, still so much we don't know and lots more to discover. Has your research given you any sense of spirituality? And I guess what I'm asking is, do you believe in something beyond this world as a result of what you've learned?
No, I don't. What I believe is that we all have transcendent sensations. We all feel something that seems beyond our normal experience in a number of situations, whether it is falling in love or when your child is born or during sexual experience. There are these things that, you know, take us beyond our normal experience. And so then the question becomes, well, you know, is it necessary to invoke a non-naturalistic explanation for that? Or can these transcendent experiences that we all have actually be understood in the context of biology? And my understanding, my feeling is that they can be understood in the context of biology, that even those things that feel so powerful and deeply humane and transcendent to us are there because they evolved to be that way.
What do you want us to take away from this book?
What I want the readers to take away from this book is not the idea that, say, touch is important, even though it is, or that touch is interesting, even though it is, but rather it's the idea that the details of how our human touch system came to be through the evolutionary process is fundamental to our human experience in the world. When we bond through a caress, when we make love, when we make consumer decisions in the store by feeling a fabric between our fingertips, all of these things are reflecting our particular human history as instantiated in the genes, cells, and wiring of our touch systems.
So what are you working on next?
Well, I have sort of a split life. So my day job is that I run a research lab here at Johns Hopkins University, and we work on things like memory storage in the brain and how the brain recovers after injury. But my night job is that I write these books, and the next book may turn out to be about the biology of food and eating, or it may turn out to be about biological rhythms. I haven't quite decided yet.
Can't wait. Interesting book. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
This is David Linden. He's a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University and the author of the book we've been talking about, Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for joining us.